This is 4:55 on Monday, October 31st. All right. Now we're ready. So, good morning. Checking on the schedule. We have now completed two-thirds of the class, week 10. Amazing. We have a exam coming up a week from today, so be aware. Beware is for today, tonight with Halloween, but be aware of the exam. So we're going to talk about Linklater. I have some clicks questions this morning. Let's see. Reminder about Chapter 5, which is due on this Friday. No late assignments there because I will be sending you solutions to that prior to the exam, so you have the actual solutions. So get those turned in on time, please. And then after the exam, on the next day, we're going to have a session in class to work on any problems associated with the project. So please be prepared for that. I certainly hope so. If not, I will give you solutions for that too. I'm meeting with the TA right after class to try to finish up the project one and the okay. Any other questions? Whoa, is it really hot in here this morning? I am just steaming. Let me now go to the clicks questions. So these questions are largely about the CRC stuff, about checksum stuff. And we're good to go. So, what do error correction schemes do? Okay, I think almost everybody's answered. So there are enough of both A and B that we need to go over again what is the way that these things work. You start with your original message, and you append some additional bits, right, to it, and you to get the message that is then transmitted to the other side, which then runs the error detection and correction algorithm on the result. And is it possible to detect all errors, that is, all changes in the bits? No, because if you think about it, some of these bigger things, the original message plus the checksum, some are considered valid and some are not valid. And any that have taken a valid message to another valid message cannot be detected. Right? Because the result is a valid message. So there's just no way that you're going to detect all possible errors. What we do is we design things so that we detect the errors that are likely to occur. You know, things like a single bit being flipped, or a small number of bits being flipped, or a run of bits being mangled, or, right? The common ones are the ones we get. So the correct answer here is able to detect some errors and correct some errors, because this is a correction scheme. But okay. And an error detection scheme using even parity, how is the parity bit chosen? Oops. Okay. So, as far as I know, parity schemes are always about the number of one bits in a message, not the number of zero bits. So, number one bit, so that gets rid of C and D. Well, most people didn't have that. So it's chosen so that, is B even possible? No, not really. The message is the message. You can't change the number of one. So the answer is A. That in an even parity scheme, the number of one bits in the message as sent is even. Okay. In an odd parity scheme, guess what? Same thing is odd. The number of one bits in the message as sent is odd. For cyclic redundancy checks, to compute the CRC, what do? Divide M by an R plus 1 bit generator, divide M extended on the right by R zeros by an R plus 1 bit generator, XOR M with the generator, or subtract the generator from it. Looks like a lot of people didn't absorb what happened on Friday. Maybe a lot of people were not here on Friday, haven't looked at the lecture. But the correct answer is B. And if you didn't understand that, or if you didn't get that or didn't understand that, you need to go back and review the slides from Friday, the lecture from Friday, and that. What we start with is a generator G, the message that's being sent extended on the right by, in this case, three zeros because we have a 4-bit generator. And what we do is we take the remainder when we do that division, but it's not numerical division, it's this division in which the subtraction is done using XOR, right, rather than actual numerical subtraction. So you need to go back and review that if you didn't get this. How about this one? So what is the checksum? The quotient of that division, the remainder of that division, or zero? Just told you the answer. The remainder, right? The remainder of that division. Joe. So how do we form having computed the CRC, how do we form the message that's actually sent over the wire. Do we add the checksum, subtract the checksum, or extend the original message with the checksum? The answer here is C. We extend the original checksum. And this is in line with what we've talked about for the way we do these error detection and correction codes. We take the message and we extend it with some more bits. So that's C. Oh, that was the wrong button. Please don't log out. Last one. This is the only one that I consider a hard question amongst these. It's not a hard question, even a slightly hard question. This is actually good, despite the fact that there are B answers and C answers. If you run the CRC division on the full received message, that is, the message as extended by the checksum, you should get zero. That we talked about that last time. If you run the CRC division on the received message, not including the checksum, but extended by zeros, you should get the checksum. Okay? So I think a case could be made for either one of these. The way it's usually done is C, right? We just take what was received and do the checksum division and see if the answer is zero. That's really easy. This is a few more steps, but you could make a case that that would work too. Okay? All right. So if you didn't do well on these, you need to review Friday's lecture. Any questions about that? So then, after we did that on Friday, we moved on to talking about multiple access protocols. We had this slide of what do we want a multiple access protocol to do for us, right? And ideally, a multiple access protocol lets a single sender use the full channel. A single sender is the only one that wants to send anything. It shares the channel fairly when multiple senders want to send. It doesn't require special nodes and clock synchronization, and it's in some sense simple. Well, we'll talk about that more as we go. So there are three big ways that we do this. One is to divide a channel into smaller pieces, and we'll talk about some ways that can be done. The big one that sort of took over the world back in 1976 or so, when it was invented, was the so-called random access protocols. Ethernet is a random access protocol. Ethernet on a broadcast medium is a random access protocol. And finally, there are the taking turns protocols, where the taking of turns is governed by what the nodes actually want to do, whereas up here in a channel partitioning scheme, the taking turns is governed by a fixed schedule, if that's how we do it. So let's look at those. So the first one, first channel partitioning scheme is the so-called time division multiple access. So multiple access means multiple people can send. Time division says we chop up time into a bunch of slots, and we have a schedule for when each node is allowed to send into a slot. So in this example, we said we're going to chop things up into six, a repeating schedule that contains six slots, and node one sends in the first slot. Node two sends if it has something to say in the second slot, three, four, etc., five, six. Anyway, so we have a repeating schedule of six slots, and you just transmit in your time, in your own time. So what does this do? This forces us to use a fixed maximum size packet. And if we don't, suppose node one only has a few bits to send, it won't use all of its slot, and that will be wasted. If node two doesn't have anything to send at all, its slot is wasted. So this, which of the desired things is this one not achieving? It's not achieving that if one node has something to send and nobody else does, that we can use the full bandwidth of the channel, right? It's not achieving the fairness, except in the case that he wants to send. If everybody wants to send, then we have fair allocation. Well, I guess even if everybody doesn't want to send, we have fair allocation, but we're still wasting a good fraction of the bandwidth. It's pretty simple. It does require some kind of clock synchronization. Everybody has to decide when the beginning of these frames is and be able to tell how big the slots are within the frames. So it's pretty simple, but it's not completely devoid of clock synchronization. Okay. Next partitioning scheme is frequency division multiple access. And this is, I don't know. For me, the analogy that works best here is music, right? If you have a bunch of people singing words on different pitches, you can pick out the words on the different pitches. This is called opera. So that works. Another way to think about it is if you send signals on with different colors of light, you know, even suppose that there are lights at different of different colors, even if they're coming from the same place, you can look at them wearing red or green or blue filters and see just the signal that's being sent on a given color. So that works. Again, we waste frequency bands that are not being used by the assigned user. And another complication of this one that's not mentioned on the slide is we've told you here about how the senders behave. We've said the senders send on different colors, in this case. What about the receivers? The problem here for the receivers is that they have to receive and separate the colors all at once, right? You have to be able to do that. And that's kind of a problem, typically, because you're saying, okay, I've got a bunch of really fast senders, and now the receiver has to be able to sort of absorb the data from them all at once. And that's maybe more than we're prepared for. Again, we need here We need frequency synchronization, right? Everybody has to agree what blue is and what red is. But that's usually done at a fairly physical level. Seems easier than time synchronization. Okay, then there's something called code division multiple access that I'm not going to cover, right? But essentially it's a way to let signals interfere with each other and nevertheless pull out the signal that you're intending to get. It's an advanced topic, let's say. Let's move on to random access protocols. So the idea with a random access protocol is that we allow everybody to send at the full channel rate. Requires no slotting of time. Instead, what we do is we allow people to transmit at the same time, and if they do, we declare failure. If somebody manages to send without somebody sending over them, that's success. But if at any time two people send at the same time, that's failure. And then we do something to randomize the way that people transmit. So we try to get away from causing collisions, but we still accept collisions. So random access protocols, sort of, define them, you have to say how you detect collisions and how you recover from collisions. And we're going to start with sort of one of the grandfathers of modern Ethernet, the so-called Aloha protocols, and then we'll move into the protocols that were used by broadcast Ethernet, and then there's this one which is used by Wi-Fi.
And I'll explain what all those letters mean. I'm not going to force you to remember a bunch of letters without knowing what they stand for. Oh, Aloha is not an acronym, however. It's just a name.
So, slotted Aloha, this was invented by folks at the University of Hawaii for a communication system. I think they had maybe instrumentation on volcanoes or on the coast or something. And they were collecting information from around an island, and they needed a way to sort of not have the devices that were sent interfere with each other, so they invented this thing called Aloha, and slotted Aloha is a variant of that. So in slotted Aloha, like in the TDMA, we have fixed size frames, certain number of bits. Time is divided up into slots that correspond to that number of bits. Okay? And you only start sending at the beginning of a slot, right? Because if you send later than the beginning of the slot, you'll overlap into the next slot. So we only start at the beginning of the slot. Already this tells us that we have to have some degree of clock synchronization. But it's not too bad, I guess, would be the way to put it. We can sort of throw in some slop around the edges to get tolerance on our clock. And if two or more nodes transmit in a slot, that's called a collision, right? Just like we said before. So the rule is, so that's sort of the general picture, but we need more if we're going to fully defined protocol. So the rule is, if your application or network layer hands you a packet to send, you send it in the first available, the next time a slot begins. You're able to tell whether a collision occurs. Everybody's able to tell whether a collision occurs. If there's no collision, that's success. If there is a collision, you keep trying to send that same packet in each subsequent slot, but with a probability less than one. So what does this mean? It means that if a collision occurs, right? Collision occurs means that at least two transmitters sent in the same slot. Right? That's the only way to get a collision. So in the next slot, they will each try again with a probability that needs to be less than a half. And say the probability was a half. Then what would happen? Then a quarter of the time they'd have a collision again. Half the time they would succeed. And another quarter of the time the slot would go empty. And we get to do the whole thing again in the next one. Okay? So that's the idea of these randomized protocols, is that a collision occurs, you try to do something that sort of spreads out the attempts to send so that subsequently collisions don't occur again. So this is an illustration of how this would work. So the labels here along the x-axis stand for collision, empty, and success. Okay. So, first slot, three nodes want to send, they all send, that's a collision. They all choose in the next slot randomly whether to transmit or not. They happen to all choose not to. In the next slot, they all choose randomly again, two of them choose. It's another collision. Next slot. Choose randomly again. Maybe only one chooses. Alright? So one of the problems with this is that the probability, you know, I said the probability, what if there are two senders, a half is not too bad a choice. But if there are three senders, a half would not be a good choice. Unfortunately, you have to define a protocol with a fixed probability. You don't know how many collisions there were. They were collisions. There's no information obtained from a collision. So that's how that works. So the pros are, again, if there's only one node that ever wants to send, it can go at the full channel rate, right? Because there'll be no collisions, and every time it gets a message, it will try to send it. It will succeed. We only need to synchronize the slots, and it's pretty simple. So the cons are we waste slots when there are collisions, there are idle slots, and some degree of clock synchronization. And so I think in the homework, I ask you to do a problem that involves finding the solution that maximizes this, right? So that's a little bit of calculus. As the number of nodes goes to infinity, what you find is that the efficiency of this is 37%. So as we get more and more nodes, about 37% of the time we succeed in using a slot. That is, a single sender sends in a slot. Neither it's empty nor it's a collision. So you can then transform that idea a little bit and say, oh, suppose we don't have these slots, right? Because slots were a problem, we had digitization. We just transmit any old time. And the result of that, compared with slotted, is that you see that we can end up with collisions that overlap what would have been multiple slots. And you work out the probabilities associated with this, and that number that previously was 37% is now half of that, 18%.
Okay, so this is not a great protocol, right? because it you build infrastructure to communicate at a certain rate, and then you less than 20% of it. Okay, so let's see what we can do that will help fix this. And these are some of the ideas that went into Ethernet. So the first one is CSMA, and you should learn what that stands for, Carrier Sense Multiple Access. So it's a multiple access protocol with carrier sensing, and that means that before you start to send, you listen to the channel and see if somebody's already sent it. Okay? This is very familiar to people who do ham radio, say. Right? It's not considered polite. Well, it's even familiar to people who have conversations in classrooms, right? Try not to talk when other people are talking. You wait.
Maybe meetings are a better analogy than classrooms, because classrooms have moderators that sort of direct things, whereas a meeting may not, and it's considered rude to interrupt when somebody's already talking. Okay? Now, that might seem like it would solve the problem, but it doesn't.
Let's see why. Once again, we have space going horizontally. Remember, last time we had space and time reversed. Well, we're back to space horizontal and time going down. So let's see how we can still have a collision here. So our second node here starts to transmit at T0. Right? And signals take finite amount of time to propagate in space. And so sometime later at T1, the signal is now visible across that space to a wire. And if at T1, somebody who has not yet seen that signal starts to transmit, they have no clue, right? There's no clue at this node that this node is transmitting. The signal hasn't propagated that far yet. So now, both transmitting. Which we draw like that, showing that, right, things are scrambled in this space. And it's a collision. Nobody can get all of what this node said because everywhere, starting at some point, the message starts being scrambled. So remember, the other thing is, if you look down a vertical slice of this, that's the message. Right? That's the time it took to transmit the message that he started sending, beginning at T0. Is that clear to everybody? Good. Okay. So that's a collision. And if both of these guys obeyed carrier sense, they didn't transmit when they knew somebody else was transmitting, but we've got a collision.
And it wastes, of course, all of the time associated with both of those packets. So how can we avoid wasting so much time when a collision occurs? Well, okay, that's just finishing off that slide. We wasted
all of this time from here down to here because both of those packets were destroyed by the collision.
So that leads us to
CSMA, Carrier Sense Multiple Access, with Collision Detection, CD. And it starts out like CSMA, and it finishes up with another step. And that is that when you detect a collision, you stop.
So our same picture.
This guy starts transmitting. He's transmitting. His signal is propagating. This guy starts transmitting, and
at some point, his signal reaches this guy, and he says, uh-oh. Takes him a few bit times, usually, to figure that out. But when he does, he goes silent. The yellow, you see, does not continue after that point. Here, similarly over here, the yellow signal eventually reaches this point, and in a few bit times we say, uh-oh, that's a collision, so we stop. And so what we've done is, compared to that previous slide, we've wasted a lot less of the bandwidth, a lot less of the time.
Is it still corrupted, though?
What?
Like, doesn't it still
corrupt? Oh, it's still corrupted, right? It's still wasted.
All of this time, from here down to here, is still wasted, but it's less wasted time than in the other picture. Okay? Neither one of those packets is any good.
Okay.
We're going to have to redo them.
Right.
But we wasted less time.
Oh, okay, so you realized before.
See, before, the yellow transmitter guy kept on transmitting until he'd sent his whole packet.
Right. So it doesn't reduce the collisions, it just reduces the amount of time it takes you to acknowledge them.
Yeah, right. Okay. So you still get collisions, but they have less bad effect. Okay, so just sort of putting some more algorithmic talk around this. You receive a datagram from your upper layer. You create your frame. You detect if the channel is idle, and if it is, you start transmission. If it's busy, you wait until the channel is idle, and then you transmit. And once again, if you succeed now in transmitting without detecting a collision throughout there, then you're done, and you can go on to the next one. If you do detect a collision, you abort. And for technical reasons, it's important that everybody know that a collision occurred. So a NIC that detects a collision actually sends a signal that forces everybody else on the medium to detect the collision as well. If there are pathological cases where one sender might detect a collision and another one not, and that would be bad because the receivers would have detected the collision, the sender detect the collision, the sender thinks the receivers got the message, but they didn't. So anybody who detects a collision makes sure that everybody knows about the collision. And then we enter what's called binary exponential backoff, where we choose a random amount of time. Remember before, in Aloha, we chose in each time interval to transmit with a fixed probability. Here, we not only choose... Well, here we choose an amount of time to wait. So we don't choose whether to send at a particular time. Instead, we choose how long it's going to be before we try again. And as the number of collisions increases, we actually choose from larger and larger distributions of time. So we don't necessarily wait longer, but we might wait longer.
That's binary exponential backoff. So it's funny, they didn't put a actual efficiency on here, but I guess we could figure it out.
Is that not the right efficiency for you?
What?
Is that not the right efficiency formula?
It is the right formula. They just didn't put a number to it. I like numbers. Mm. Right. So figured it out. It's 1 times 1 plus 5 over T prop over T trans. So the efficiency goes to 1 as T prop goes to 0. Well, that makes sense, right? That as the network gets smaller and smaller, the amount of time that you have to wait to detect a collision gets smaller and smaller, and so you waste less and less of the time. So that makes sense. And similarly, as T trans goes to infinity, well, then this term goes to 0, and this term goes to 0, and we get 1 over 1. Yes. So then we get 1 over 1 again. And again, that makes sense. It says, well, gee, if we let somebody transmit forever and nobody else ever tries, then, you know, collision, a carrier sense keeps everybody else from transmitting, and that guy can just keep transmitting forever. So, what we did, what happened for Ethernet was that we chose some particular sizes of the network. So like 100 meters was the length of a broadcast Ethernet usually. That's what people said that was the biggest it could be. So that limits how big the prop can be. And we chose a particular maximum size of a packet. And that limits this, so you can't go into infinity in either one of these things, and thereby you get some nice engineering style decisions about the efficiency that you can achieve on Ethernet. And then when we talk about Ethernet, they mentioned it, but as I recall, it's sort of around 68% or so. You can use that much of the network when there are multiple senders all trying to send. Doesn't require slotting, right? There's no clock synchronization needed here. It doesn't require a centralized controller. It's pretty nice, and took over the world. So, to review. We've talked about channel partitioning, and we've talked about random access protocols, and we observed that the channel partitioning things use the channel efficiently and fairly if there's a lot of traffic, but they don't use it, if there's a lot of senders, but they don't use it efficiently when there is only a few senders. The random access protocols are really efficient at low loads because it's very unlikely that there'll be collisions if only one person is trying to send them, but there are no collisions, so that works well. But when there are high loads, then you get a high load meaning a lot of senders, you get a lot of collisions, and that reduces the efficiency. Okay, so the third big class is the taking turns protocols that try to do better than that. And there are schemes in which a single node is sort of in charge of directing the resource to different nodes at different times. You essentially say, I want to send a very short message that says, I want to send. It arrives at the director node, who then sort of says, it's your turn. And it has problems of, we're reserving some of the bandwidth in this scheme for doing this negotiation, right? There are these extra messages that are being sent in order to do the negotiation, and we have this single point of failure, which is not thought to be a good thing.
So that one is often used in
sort of industrial control systems that have sort of very dumb nodes out at the edges and do that.
It's really going away in the world, I think. Oh, isn't that clever? All right. And maybe that poll results in no data, right? Nothing to send. Huh? All right.
So there's another scheme called token passing that attempts to get away from that by arranging all the nodes in a ring. And the idea is that we pass a token around the ring, and when you have the token, you're allowed to send, and when you don't, you're not. And so,
I think this one has some cleverness. Nothing to send. Pass the token. There's a token says, okay, you can send now. So the data goes. Data goes all the way around, and when data has gone all the way around, then the original node knows that it has everybody, and the token can be passed on to the next node. How rude. So
at that point, the token gets passed here, and we do the same.
So there's some overhead, of course, once again, with sending this token.
You don't get to even try to send something until you have the token. So that's perhaps a way to that may cause some additional latency in message sending. And if the token gets lost, which amazingly happened in original designs, then the whole thing stops. Right? So there's complication associated with the algorithms needed to recover the token. So suppose the token disappears. Then everybody on the ring is going to notice that the token has disappeared, right? Because it expects to get the token so often and it doesn't show up. So everybody notices the token has disappeared. How do we decide who's going to make a new token? Well, that's a tricky problem, isn't it? Because everybody's supposedly equal, so you can't just have everybody do the same thing, because then everybody either generates a token or doesn't. But it's worse than that, because we're not even allowed to have two tokens. So it would be a bad thing if two nodes sort of randomly decided to generate a token, because then we'd have two tokens, and that would not be good either. So IBM invented the token ring idea just very slightly after the Ethernet was invented, probably within a year or two, because they thought that the efficiency of the Ethernet, 68% or whatever it was just too low, and the unpredictability was just too low, and so they wanted something that was rock solid. So they invented this idea of the token ring, and then they set out to build. And
what time is it? Darn. I'll have to tell you the story about that next time. It's a pretty good story. So. It's a pretty good story. So I leave you on tenterhooks.
But I just did find a few classes. I didn't really miss whatever. It probably won't be right. No, I just defined my grad class and like.